From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Homeland Security Act, passed this week by both houses of Congress, will result in the biggest overhaul of the federal bureaucracy in 50 years. It will also have broad ramifications for the relationship between the federal government and its citizens. Among other changes, it will allow the government authority to deny previously routine requests under the Freedom of Information Act. For instance, vulnerabilities of power plants could be hidden from view, a circumstance that concerns Mark Tapscott. He's the director of the Center for Media and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and he joins me now. Mark, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with the obvious. What is it about the Homeland Security Act that threatens us?
Well, my particular concern deals with a particular section in it that declares that material and information and data that a private company voluntarily makes available to the government as part of the effort against terrorism would be exempt from the FOI. You don't have to be a Harvard lawyer to imagine the many ways that one could construe all kinds of things to be related to the war on terrorism.
Well, in dealing with freedom of information requests in the past, the government has always been able to invoke, in a broad way, national security as a reason for not disclosing right. information that journalists or any citizen is seeking. Why is it materially different to have this anti-terrorism component in the act?
Well, I've been a journalist for 15 years now, and I was in government before then in both the executive branch and the legislative branch. And I can tell you that government will inevitably tend to interpret its own statutes and regulations to its own benefit. And that's the problem with this. On its face, perhaps it does seem somewhat specific. In fact, it's not. It says all information voluntarily turned over that has to do with critical infrastructure issues in the war on terrorism. That is a broad, broad category of potential kinds of information. And as the years go by and there are new regulations issued and there are more court cases that deal with specific situations, that will tend to become even broader. And what you end up with is an invitation to a wholesale diversion from public disclosure of a lot of information that the people ought to be able to see.
Now, you had a piece in the Washington Post, and in it was a delicious detail. And it harkened back to June 20th of 1966, when a young congressman stood on the floor of the House passionately advocating the need for the then under consideration Freedom of Information Act. And that young congressman was?
As a matter of fact, he's the Secretary of Defense today, Donald Rumsfeld. he was one of the co-sponsors of the original Freedom of Information Act in 1966. And if you go back in the congressional record and read the floor speeches, he actually made two notable speeches on behalf of the FOI, and they were, as you said, very passionate and absolutely right on the mark.
Oh, sweet irony, because the Pentagon now is, after all, a serial non-discloser of unclassified information.
Now, Bob, I detect a certain note of cynicism.
Well, that actually gets to my next question or observation. I don't know what it is. But I want to point out that you are not from the American Civil Liberties Union. You're not from the sort of usual suspects on the left. You are representing the Heritage Foundation, which is widely and I think accurately described as a conservative think tank. You're not one of the chicken littles of liberalism speaking here. So should we take special note of what you're saying?
Well, I'm not so sure that maybe some of my colleagues in the Bush administration might be wondering if you're right about that, me not being one of the chicken littles. But I believe that accountability in government is a fundamental First Amendment issue that there should really be no surprise that conservatives would be very concerned about it.
All right. Mark, thanks very much.
Bob, it has been a pleasure.
Mark Tapscott is the director of the Center for Media and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation.
More than 100 journalists, among them many hardened war correspondents, gathered this month to discuss the particular challenges they face in covering a prospective war in Iraq. They're all members of a newly formed group called Military Reporters and Editors, or MREs. Washington Post MRE Tom Ricks was at the conference.
It really was a remarkable set of conversations, really peer-to-peer, not a lot of theorizing, very practical. How do you get access? How do you communicate? How do you cover this sprawling, complex, and diverse institution called the U.S. military? And how do you do it in such a way that you can survive? We were actually just passing tips back and forth in one of the sessions, and it was stuff like, when you're in a third world country, wash your hands frequently, 5 or 6 times a day. And it was also theoretical stuff like, go back and read Ernie Pyle's coverage of the U.S. Army in World War II to learn how to cover a unit in combat.
But that hardly matters if you can't get anywhere near the action, I would think. The Boston Globe recently quoted Air Force Colonel Jay DeFrank as saying, oh, we're committed to access, but it's probably not going to be the access you want.
It's going to be particularly difficult in this environment because you are looking at a battlefield in which there's a significant chance that chemical weapons will be drifting across the battlefield. There's also a possibility of biological agents. And so it's a very hazardous battlefield. It's going to be one in which it's difficult to operate independently. And so you really are dependent on the U.S. military for some sort of access to that environment.
And it seems that the U.S. military has some plans to jam satellite feeds.
I'm of two minds about that sort of thing. You could show an adversary your location and the location of a U.S. military unit by making phone calls without being aware of that. So I think the military does have a right to protect itself. At the same time, there are ways of having satellite communications that do not hazard the military. For example, by sending reporters 10 miles away before they file. That's the sort of thing that we would like to discuss now in a fairly calm, quiet environment in Washington rather than try to duke it out with some Army colonel on the battlefield.
What other sorts of issues would you like to discuss now with the military?
One thing we've discussed already, and I want to mention because I've been very critical of the Pentagon's restrictions on information, something they've done very well already, is begin giving reporters training on things like mine awareness and chemical and biological protection. I took the U.S. Army's mine awareness training before I went into Bosnia in 1995, and it was extremely helpful. It's a gift that keeps on giving. Some of that training came back to me when I was in Afghanistan earlier this year. You owe it as a reporter to be at least minimally aware of what a minefield looks like, because if you get a leg blown off or worse, you're going to be a burden to them.
The underlying assumption there is that they're going to let reporters embed, so to speak, with the troops, and there doesn't seem to be any indication that that is going to happen.
Well, I would differ with you on that. We keep on getting promises out of the Pentagon that there will be some sort of embedding. It's not clear what. In my experience, every single rifle company, that is about, say, 150 troops, can have one reporter without causing any disruption. Whether that happens, I'm not sure, though.
If the Pentagon is so restricted, will it actually be easier to cover the Iraqi side than the American side?
It shouldn't come to that, because I think the American people do want to know what happens with their troops, their sons and daughters, on the battlefield. It is true that during the Afghan War, the best way to cover what was going on was not to try to get with American forces, because they wouldn't let you at the outset, or to take information from the Pentagon, because the Pentagon really didn't say anything about the war, but to get with the Northern Alliance. And I think that's one approach that a lot of reporters will be taking here, not so much to get with the Iraqi government, because they're not going to be helpful either, but perhaps to try to find U.S. allies who can be more open.
So there'll be a story. It may not be told from the American side if the Pentagon won't allow reporters in.
And the point about that is that if there is not sufficient access given by the Pentagon, reporters will go out and try to cover things independently, unilaterally. And that is going to get some reporters killed.
Tom Ricks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Ricks is the Washington Post Pentagon reporter and author of Soldier's Duty, a novel about an American military intervention in Afghanistan. Joining me now is another MRE, Sig Christensen, military reporter for the San Antonio Express. He is currently at the Marine Corps base in Quantico, Virginia, undergoing the Pentagon's reporter training. Sig, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, is it as rigorous as we've been hearing it is?
Well, early in the week, we spent a lot of time with the Navy, and we were on board ships. We were on the USS Iwo Jima and spent a night out there and got a sense of what it's like to live on a ship. We went to several other ships, including the USS Harry S. Truman, which is a nuclear aircraft carrier. So we basically been getting a taste of what it's like to be a new lieutenant in basic training. It hasn't been that rigorous, needless to say, but it has been intense.
But it sounds a little bit more like a PR enterprise than an actual training session. Are you learning anything here that you can actually use if you were covering war in the field?
To some degree. I mean, you do get kind of a Chamber of Commerce tour of some things. But some of the things we've done, such as the nuclear, chemical, and biological training, which we just completed, was very helpful. And when you start reading about and thinking about the different kinds of weapons that are out there and the different ways that you can die, very painfully, I'll add, it's a very frightening thought, and it sobers you up. I will tell you that not all of it has been terribly exciting, but on the whole, I think you come out with an appreciation of what these people are doing and the discipline and effort it takes for them to do their jobs. Is this Pentagon PR? To some degree, I'm sure it is. They're trying to do their dead level best to have the American people believe that they're trying to reach out to us.
It seems that this is, at the very least, an effort solely to make the appearance of something rather than to actually be doing it.
Well, it's also a good start. But the true litmus test will come when the fighting starts. And if a war does come, that's the proof in the pudding. And that's where the American people will know whether we're getting the access or whether we're being restricted. I think that that's a concern that we all have. And while they are reaching out, and I credit them for doing it, I think all of us still have concerns about how that's going to shake out.
And what's next on the agenda?
What's next on the agenda? Our 5-mile PT march tomorrow. We're going to have a march with our packs, and that'll be the culminating event of the course. And I've heard that snow is forecast for tomorrow, so if we end up getting snow and we're marching, we're going to look like the battling bastards of Bastogne all over again. Although I will tell you that we make for pretty lousy soldiers at this point.
Well, Sig, thank you very much for letting us call you on your cell phone.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and thank you very much for having me.
Sig Christensen is the military reporter for the San Antonio Express.
Coming up, Glamour magazines rely on white, while sports news and comic book heroes take on a new complexion.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Next time you're at the newsstand, take a quick scan of the magazine rack and look for a minority cover girl. If you find one, in all probability you'll be looking at a copy of Essence or Latina magazines, edited for ethnic audiences, because according to a study by the New York Times, non-whites continue to be substantially underrepresented on magazine covers, except in teen-targeted titles and such fantasy-pandering men's magazines as Maxim. When Halle Berry appeared on the cover of Cosmopolitan, she was only the fifth black woman to show up there ever, and the first since Naomi Campbell in 1990. Joining us to discuss the phenomenon is Times reporter David Carr. David, welcome to OTM.
Hey, thanks for having me, Bob.
Let me tell you a personal experience of mine. About 10 or 12 years ago, I was at a magazine where the editor was sharing with me his philosophy of journalism. And the way he did this was going over a list of his last 12 covers. And he gave me the circulation figures for the various issues. And he took the trouble to note that on the issues where white men were on the cover, their sales were the highest, white women was the second highest, and that there was an immediate drop-off if you went to any sort of other skin complexion. He was reporting this as just a fact of life, but it drove their decisions on what to put on the cover. Apart from the how disturbing that is from a journalistic point of view and from a cultural point of view, from a business point of view, I guess it makes sense if they sell more magazines if there's white people on the cover, doesn't it?
Magazine people are not inherently less enlightened than the rest of the population, and they were hewing to certain racial standards because it was in their business interest. If you talk to a black male, I talked to the agent of one of the more famous black actors in Hollywood, he can't get on a magazine cover. Meanwhile, selling movie after movie after movie, because there's a belief throughout the industry that his mere presence will depress sales more than anything. What I tried to argue in the piece is those standards may be changing. In the eyes of Madison Avenue, far and away the most important impressionable consumers are expressing very specific different preferences in matters of race and product endorsement. Teen magazines began consistently using minorities at a rate of, say, 1 out of 3 back in the mid-90s. And that trend is slowly, and I must emphasize very slowly, leaking into mainstream media.
There's a quote in your piece from the editor of Cosmopolitan, Kate White, and she says that the absence of non-white women on the cover of Cosmo reflects the celebrities that Hollywood produces, not the magazine's editorial preferences. I'm not buying that. Are you buying that?
No, I'm not buying it because Cosmopolitan almost half the time uses models, not famous people. And when they do put a model on the cover, they don't generally choose someone who is not white with very large hair and a real big smile. Magazines are aspirational in their format. You're supposed to be able to see yourself when you look at that. Not you and I, of course, Bob, but the young woman buying Cosmo is supposed to look at that and say, that's what I would look like when I come into the room. And they have it down to a very scientific sort of formula. And magazines are not a hugely risky business. They don't take a lot of chances. Cosmo's version of taking a big risk is choosing a brunette instead of a blonde.
All right, let's talk about Halle Berry for a moment. She's black. She's absolutely magnificent. But she is beautiful in a very Caucasian sort of way. And a lot of the black models and actresses who have broken through into the mainstream have kind of aquiline noses. And I wonder if in your survey you were able to determine whether this sort of acceptably white-looking version of blackness still rules.
Do you see somebody with very dark skin and African features on the cover of any magazine that is marketed on a mass level? Absolutely not. And a lot of what's gone on in terms of the diversity that magazines do brag about is come from Latinas and crossover stars like Jennifer Lopez. It isn't so much after all these years that black is beautiful, but a certain version of non-whiteness seems to finally be acceptable on the cover of magazines.
All right, David Carr, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Carr is a staff writer for the New York Times. For a lot of sports fans, ESPN's flagship show SportsCenter with Stuart Scott is must-see TV on Sunday night. In fact, Scott's success has made him essential to ESPN, which has tapped him to anchor its new Wednesday night NBA basketball broadcasts and its pregame coverage of Monday Night Football on sister network ABC. He's best known for punctuating plays with Booyah or Holla, with the attitude of the Gen Y athletes he covers. But to fans, Scott brings more to the job than his hip-hop-tinged calls, OTM's Leon Winter reports.
Here's how Stuart Scott called the highlight of a touchdown pass and a quarterback sack in a recent NFL game.
Very next play, Collins gets silly nutty with Ron Dixon. 8 yards. Dixon, talk about nimble barista cup. Oh, just getting both feet in. 14 zip G-men. Third quarter, 17-0 Giants. Uh-oh, Michael Strahan about to put the beat down, clock down on Martin Grinnell. Yeah, dog, we know that.
Stuart Scott brings the highlights with the language and rhythm of old-school rap. But as he sees it, it's just being himself and writing that way, too.
Writing is better if it's kept simple. Every sentence doesn't need to have perfect noun-verb agreement. I've said ain't on the air because I sometimes use ain't when I'm talking. Cincinnati Bengals thought that they were going to go 12-4 this year. Man, they ain't going 12-4. I'll write that because I'm going to write like I talk.
Can I ask you a quick question? The coaches... It's election night, and Scott is tapping out his script for the 11 o'clock Sports Center. The theme? Spoofing the cliches of network news election coverage by grafting them on to the cliches of sports highlight coverage. He sits in a cubicle on an open floor crammed with desks in front of the glassed-in studio set. He's working it out.
Legions of great men who've lived and worked in our nation's capital and have shaped our nation as long and distinguished. Truman, Roosevelt, Lincoln, Kennedy, LBJ,
Eisenhower, Agnew, Quayle.
All right, maybe not all of them.
But Lincoln, Jefferson, Jordan. Michael Jordan, former governor of Illinois, is now Speaker of the House. The legislation on the House floor, a bill that would increase the Wizards' 40% shooting. Wizards in Minnesota to face the Timberwolves. There's your Speaker of the House. Speak it, Michael. Speak, Mike.
Scott calls writing the most fun part of the job. Like many fabled sportscasters before him, Scott has Southern roots, but his are a little different. He was born on Chicago's Black South Side. His family moved to a mostly white neighborhood in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, when he was 7.
Most of our friends were white. In the South, we experienced, you know, some black kids who gave us a hard time because you talk white. We didn't talk white. We talked fairly proper. Plus, we had a Midwestern accent, so we didn't have a Southern accent either. So it wasn't really talking white. It was talking different.
Scott's difference from expectations, white and black, have made him a standout, even among ESPN's quirky anchor corps. It's also made him a target.
I got this the other day.
To erase this message, press 7.
Just to hear.
You're such a douchebag, man. Why don't you stop being a nigger on the air, okay, brother? Yeah. West Coast calling you out, man. You're a punk. Later.
I had a black guy call me one time. He said, you know, he didn't appreciate, you know, all you're trying to do is drag our race down and using, you know, improper language and, you know, talking street slang. You know, we're better than that. All right, man, we're better than that. That's not going to make me change what I do and how I do it.
One of those things is an occasional homey tribute to an outstanding player that invokes a sense of black community as extended family. It sounds like, oh, he making his kinfolk so proud. You know them, Ray Ray and Pookie, Lucretia, Moesha, Baby Daddy, and all of them. And where did that come from?
Life. That came from life. That came from every cookout, every barbecue that you go to with extended family. We all know somebody named Pookie. We all know a Nuck Nuck. There's a Ray Ray. Isn't there a Ray Ray in your family somewhere? In your family or your neighborhood, there's a Ray Ray. When there's a big barbecue, Ray Ray's there, Moesha Baby Daddy. We as black America know those people. And that one, look, that one's for us. That's just for us. That's not for white America.
After reflection, Scott admits that if you change Moesha to Annie Mae, it could be any family barbecue in America. Scott grew up an avowed jock of all sports. He played club football through 4 years at the University of North Carolina, where he majored in broadcast communications. Critics, like veteran New York Sports Talk host Mike Francesa, say Scott often seems to confuse his off-screen identification with athletes with his on-screen role as a sports journalist.
I know Stuart Scott likes to be very chummy with the players, which I think is very dangerous if you're going to cover them. I think that is dangerous. I do notice that he sometimes will, after being around a player or being with a player, you know, slap hands with them or have some little cute response with them or something that almost in some way hints at friendship as much as I'm here to cover you.
Scott answers that calling a player dog or slapping them five after an interview is not fawning, it's cultural fluency. Scott says he's not bound by anybody's journalistic conventions because he grew up following athletes, not broadcasters. Earlier this year, Scott nearly lost an eye when a football hurled from a machine hit him in the face. Scott was attending a day of preseason training camp with the New York Jets. The injury knocked him off the air for several weeks. But it didn't shake his belief that being the best flows from a singular conviction that you are the best at whatever you think you can do.
You got to know that you're better than anybody. Because to me, if you don't go in like that, you're going to lose. They're going to punk you out. On any stage, court, business venture, on the anchor desk, whatever, you got to go in believing, I can do this better than anybody.
Stuart Scott says he is who he is, and in Scott speak, it ain't no act. For On the Media, I'm Leon Winter.
Dude, what's up with Kendall Gill's hair?
I have no idea what he's trying to do.
KG got some mad crazy dreads. Kendall Gill looks like Ricky Williams up in this mug, man. NBA tonight at midnight. This man right here, Tim Legler, will be in the house. And then tomorrow, NBA Wednesday, ESPN has NBA kicking the flavor live.
When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield must yield. If he's led to a fight and a duel is due, then the red and the white and the blue will come through when Captain America throws his mighty shield.
African American culture and history is making its mark retroactively on a classic comic book hero called Captain America. This week, Marvel Comics kicked off a series that reimagines the story called Truth, Red, White, and Black. Written by Robert Morales, it begins with the revelation that the Blonde Army reject, Steve Rogers, was not the first American to be injected with super soldier serum that turned him into Captain America. In fact, it seems that the government had been testing the super soldier serum on black GIs long before then. So there's a black Captain America, and his existence has been a secret until now. The premise was drawn from a dark episode in America's real history, that of the Tuskegee experiment, when between 1932 and 1972, hundreds of black sharecroppers were withheld treatment for syphilis so the government could observe the progress of their disease. That was the inspiration for the new Captain America, according to Axel Alonso, editor of Truth, Red, White, and Black.
Does it stand to reason that Uncle Sam used as its primary guinea pigs blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white boys from the heartland? We could sit here and talk about issues of race and class in contemporary society and agree to disagree, but I think everyone understands that the Civil Rights Movement was a response to a condition in our country at a particular point in time, and that is the era in which this story takes place.
So why Captain America 60 years after the fact? Why did you choose this particular story?
Captain America is the physical embodiment of American might and virtue. He was developed in the 40s to fend off the Nazi tide. He was reinvigorated in the 60s to fight supervillains on the streets of New York. He has never been a static character. And if you don't use this character to examine America itself, then with what character do you do that?
Kyle Baker is the artist for the series, and he's on the line from his home in L.A. Thanks for coming in, Kyle.
Why, thank you.
The book has a beautiful cinematic look to it. What's been influencing the style and the feel of the miniseries?
Well, I've been looking at a lot of the old Jack Kirby cartoons. He's the guy who created Captain America with Joe Simon.
Well, there's a lot of strong jaws and a kind of a stripped-down look to it. It has
yeah.
a lot of graphic power.
Yeah, that's Kirby. I wanted to make it clear to the fans of Captain America that we weren't making fun of Captain America or putting him down in any way. So I thought by, you know, being true to the original creator's vision, it sort of puts people at ease.
It's worth noting that prior to publication, the project was very controversial. A lot of people came out of the woodwork assuming that this project would do something to besmirch the integrity of an icon that everyone had come to love. And I can assure people that it does anything but that. Some people have felt that this is going to be some politically correct tract when, in fact, nothing could be further from the case. Some people have assumed that this is looking to divide people, draw a line between whites and blacks, when, in fact, I think it does anything but that as well. The end of this story are, we'll refer to him as our black Captain America, and our Captain America are linked as brothers. They're hardly at odds with one another.
One part of the story that I find unique is that though white people never knew the truth behind Captain America, in your miniseries, black people always knew. They always knew. So what does this detail represent? Kyle?
When Bob told me about that, I thought it was a great idea because there are a lot of things that are known in the black community that you wouldn't get from school and stuff. So I thought it was entirely plausible that black people would know that their first Captain America was black and that nobody else would.
Kyle touches upon a good point there. You know, a random sample, you ask a black person what the word Tuskegee means, they'll know. You ask a white person and a vast majority will think Tuskegee Airmen because of some miniseries they saw on television late at night. You know, the title of this story is very, very, very pertinent. What Robert is attempting to do here is to give the reader as close as they can to an immersion experience of what it felt like to be an African-American man in, you know, late 30s, early 40s America, dealing with the world as it was shifting and changing. The story in issue one picks up in the days preceding Pearl Harbor. Issue two picks up with basic training, whereby you see the men thrown together and dealing with the situation. As things proceed, you understand the irony of fighting for certain freedoms abroad while not knowing what your future at home will be.
A couple of months ago, we interviewed Stan Lee and Tom Brevoort. Marvel had just revealed that the Thing from the Fantastic Four was Jewish. Do you think there are other specific characters who may be ripe for revelation?
Well, I can tell you that there's one character that we're looking at right now who's the longest-running Western character who we'll be revisiting with a real twist.
Mm-hmm.
It will be anything but a straight Western. Not to give too much away. But,
but we can read into that line, perhaps?
You might be able to.
Well, Axel Alonso, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Axel Alonso is the editor, and Kyle Baker is illustrating Truth, Red, White, and Black. Mm-hmm. Kyle, thanks to you, too.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, Olympic anxiety and a new way to tell the story of Rwandan genocide.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Up until a week before the announcement that New York had been selected as the U.S. nominee to host the 2012 Summer Games, many locals were unaware that the city was actually in the running at all. Though organizers insist that New Yorkers are overwhelmingly in favor of having the Olympics, Some still have questions about the cost, the traffic, and where exactly they're holding the pentathlon. As the public tries to get answers about hosting the world's most celebrated sporting event, they're finding an unexpected source of skepticism, the New York sports media. On the media's John Solomon reports.
It didn't take long after New York won the right to bid for the 2012 Olympics for local sports talk radio to turn the thrill of victory into the agony of victory.
Outside of the Olympics being here, which does, I don't really care about one way or the other myself, well, what exactly am I getting out of it down the road?
Chris Russo, along with Mike Francesa, hosts the city's top-rated sports talk radio show, Mike and the Mad Dog, on WFAN.
They're just going to have trouble convincing me that all these things that they're building outside of the Olympic Stadium is going to be that beneficial to the average New York citizen.
That's the question to me, is who's going to dip into their pocket and pay all this money?
Their qualms have been shared by an overwhelming majority of local sports columnists, which is at odds with the mostly favorable coverage in the other parts of the paper, as well as by the local TV stations.
The response from the New York City electronic media on that Saturday night was essentially just gratuitous chauvinism, cheerleaderism, boosterism.
Phil Mushnick is a sports columnist at the New York Post.
New York won. We won anything. We're number one. We're Miss America. We're Miss Congeniality. We won something. We could have won, you know, the Iraqi parliament elections. And the people sitting there watching us were sitting there, I surmise, saying, what the heck? What's this all about? Who asked for this?
In a Newsday Online survey, 73.5% of the jocks' populi agreed. The letters printed in the Daily News' Question of the Week feature also ran 7-2 against the bid. But a survey taken by the NYC 2012 Organizing Committee found that 84% of New Yorkers favor hosting the Olympics, according to the group's executive director, Jay Kriegel. In addition, the bid has the support of every top area elected official. Kriegel doesn't think the city's chances will be hurt by the criticism of the sports commentariat.
For whatever reason, these guys on the soapbox are doing this. So who are they speaking for? So there are guys who are unhappy about it. But let's both be clear about one thing. It is a very uninformed discussion. Whether that's our fault or theirs is not the point. Objectively, though, there isn't anything intelligent. They don't know what they're talking about. They haven't studied the bid, and they know nothing about the history of Olympic Games. So it's a rant right now.
NYC 2012 has dealt extensively with the city's newspaper editorial boards, speaking with them up to 5 times. And it has paid off. All 4 major dailies have written editorials enthusiastically supporting the bid. The newspapers have also made significant financial contributions to the organizing committee, but have chosen not to disclose that in their pages. The Post's Phil Mushnick says that's a serious oversight.
Not only should newspapers make it clear that they've contributed money to this endeavor, but they should make it clear that they've entered a per se conflict of interest, and furthermore should admit that to being ashamed of themselves.
The New York Times donated at least $300,000 in cash or in-kind services, according to the NYC 2012 website. Times spokesperson Kathy Park says that it is the paper's policy to disclose that in editorials when, quote, the company has a financial interest in an issue we're writing about. She goes on to say, we don't necessarily mention when the company has made a charitable contribution or otherwise has given money in its capacity as a corporate citizen. No matter how altruistic the Times' motivations, should New York get the Olympics, the paper will no doubt see an increase in circulation and advertising, as happened with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution during the 96 games. One of the few local sports media personalities who has come out in favor of the bid is Al Troutwig, who hosts the Angles talk show on the Madison Square Garden cable network and has covered 9 Olympics. He says that the press box pundits are geared much more towards the major team sports.
People who have lived their lives as fans of mainstream sports have never really bought into, you know, watching the Olympics and seeing the joy of Johnny Mosley, you know, winning a gold medal. They've never done that.
According to Troutwig, Olympic events, like Mosley's freestyle skiing, don't create much controversy, the lifeblood of New York sports media.
Let me ask you a question. What makes more sense if you're trying to generate readers and viewers and listeners? Does it make sense to come on and go, oh, this is a great idea. Okay, next caller. It doesn't make sense to do that. It makes sense to bash it and hammer it and kill it because you can go off on a harangue in that way.
Critical sports talk hosts and columnists were not something that the Beijing Organizing Committee had to deal with on the way to their successful bid to host the 2008 Games. Olympic Committee Executive Director Jay Kriegel would obviously prefer unanimous support, but he's armed with answers to all challenges as the process moves forward to 2005, when the site is finally chosen. Answers like these: that the games will pay for themselves, that the traffic will be expertly managed, and that the pentathlon will be held in the Bronx. For On the Media, I'm John Solomon.
"100 Days" is a feature film, the first that depicts the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, where Hutus massacred at least 500,000 of the Tutsi minority. It was shot at the actual scenes of mass murder with people who saw it all, but it is not a documentary. The director and co-producer Nick Hughes already had made many documentaries of the horror. This time Hughes and his co-producer Eric Cabrera, who lost 32 family members during those 100 days, wanted to find a new way to tell the story. So they hired witnesses, Tutsis and Hutus, as actors, and Hughes created a love story to put a human face on the slaughter. The result is 100 Days.
The Tutsi came here. They refused to live with us, to marry us, or to share power with us. There is only one solution. They must go!
Yes!
So that they never come back.
Yes!
You are going to clean the land for your children. You must not be frightened. The decision has been made for you. You only have to do it once. But it has to be done once and for all, and it will be forgotten.
Yes!
Get rid of women and their baby rats. Don't leave any rats for the future. The time for work is now.
Yeah!
What we have waited for is happening.
Utu power, power, Utu power.
Director Nick Hughes joins us now from Rwanda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you're a documentary cameraman who's covered the war in Rwanda. You have hours and hours of powerful footage of the genocide. Why did you decide to tell the story of such a dramatic historical event as a fictional drama?
I worked on so many documentaries after the genocide, and in many ways a documentary is the best way to tell the history of such an enormous event as the genocide in Rwanda. But documentaries about Rwanda aren't watched, and if they are watched, they're watched by people who already know and have assumptions about Rwanda. And therefore you're preaching to the converted, and 100 Days is made to explain in a dramatic form, to explain what happened in Rwanda to an audience who has no interest in Rwanda.
Two of the most important characters in 100 Days are Josette and Baptiste, both young lovers. Was this lover subplot a way of drawing people in?
You know, love is a universal theme. The audience, even if they're in Tokyo or Toronto, can immediately relate to the hopes and fears of that couple.
I'd like to share with you my reaction to the movie. It seemed to me that when you cleaved closest to the actual events, it had the most impact. And when you moved off to the plots that you had imposed to attract the audience, because the actors were frankly rather wooden, it was when my mind began to wander.
Indeed. I mean, none of the actors are professional actors, but they are Rwandan, and they were portraying something under whose shadow they lived and through which they had lived. Maybe the film fails on this, and maybe we should have had very professional actors from Europe or wherever, but they weren't going to be Rwandan. Some people find the acting wooden. Some people find it, because they're Rwandan acting their own story, twice as powerful. I think it would be terribly wrong to have a full, glossy Hollywood film made, because at that point, that's where you bring in all sorts of stories which have absolutely nothing to do with the genocide. And that's what's going to happen in the next year. There's going to be many films made about people who did little in the genocide or betrayed people in the genocide, and they're going to be presented as heroes. 100 Days doesn't do that.
And I was fascinated by your use of the extraneous characters who came through, the UN soldiers, the journalists. You have journalists, people holding cameras, just as you yourself did during the actual genocide, scattered all through.
Just hold on, hold on. Catherine, just wait right there.
Were they Tutsi?
I don't know. Yes, they were Tutsi.
Is that why they killed them?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Who were they?
They were friends. Mr. Kabera was not liked. He was in an opposition political party.
Is that why they killed him?
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
Who
maybe.
Killed him?
I can't tell. I don't know.
They're generally in the way. They're irrelevant. They're taking no moral stand, and they have no impact on what's going on around them. It's as if they were dropped from the moon.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly what happened. You had UN soldiers from the West. You had aid workers. You had expats, you had journalists, all of them betrayed the Rwandan people. The media took absolutely no part in the genocide in it, exposing it to the international community. It brushed it off with cliches, caricatures. The aid workers, 99% of them just got on the plane and left. The expats just left their servants to be slaughtered and evacuated while they evacuated their dogs. And the UN, who were there, brought in to protect the Tutsi population, to keep the peace, just ran away. And there's a worrying thing, I think, at the moment, that the, particularly in the media, in film, in documentaries, in books, is that there is now a sort of myth-making about Westerners in Rwanda, that somehow they suffered. They didn't suffer at all. I didn't lose anybody there, you know, compared to someone who lost their entire family, generations slaughtered in a month.
It's clear that you don't have much respect for those characters who wander through your story. You don't pay much attention to them at all. And yet you yourself, when you were there, videotaped a machete-wielding man beating a woman and her daughter pleading for their lives, and it was broadcast all over the world in 1994. Do you think it did nothing?
Well, it was something very, very small. I mean, I didn't save anybody. I didn't put my camera down and save any children, and nor did anybody else, and nor did those people who sat at home and watched those two women being murdered, watching their television in Europe or America. Nothing happened. There was no great outcry for something to be done.
In an effort to tell your story in a way that would be popular and not cheapen or distort it, you tried to cleave a sort of middle course. You put in a love story, but you offered no redemption for any of the characters. There isn't anybody who is saved. There isn't anybody who isn't irreparably damaged. Here's a clip of a little girl talking to a UN soldier in front of one of the mass graves.
Did you see what happened?
They put all the Tutsis in the ground and in the pit latrines.
Did you know them?
My friend Etan is there with his whole family.
If he was your friend, don't you miss him?
No, he belongs in a pit latrine. It's natural. He was a Tutsi. They killed all the Tutsis because Tutsis smell bad.
Given that the story ends on a note of absolute despair, is there any technique, including a love story, that you think would be able to keep the audience there?
There's nothing positive about genocide. You can't come out with some glimmer of hope. Genocide is all negative. It is all dark and evil, and the suffering that people go through is beyond imagination. But if there's some understanding and some sympathy, and there's some belief that Rwandans were human beings amongst an international audience, then that's a great step.
What has been the different reactions of the audiences you've played this for? For instance, how are they reacting in Rwanda?
In Rwanda, it was really too much. The audience just sat in silence for a moment at the end and then just fled from the cinema. I think very few people in the audience in Rwanda actually watched the film. I think most of them went inside themselves. When we show it to an audience in the West, particularly in America, I have to say, and Canada, where the interest in 100 Days has been great, when the film is finished, there's so many more questions that the audience have. They want to know much more about Rwanda. We normally get thrown out of the cinema after about sort of 30 minutes or 40 minutes if Eric Cabrera or I are answering questions from the audience.
It's been shown in the U.S. mostly at film festivals, and I assume you're searching for a distributor.
One of the problems, particularly in the United States, is that the film doesn't present Africa in a positive light. Some people would say that it sort of continues the negative story about Africa. The problem with that is what about those people who died? What about that 1 million people? What about their history? What about Rwanda? If you just want to tell positive stories, then you can't talk about Rwanda and you can't talk about those people and their suffering and the survivors who to this day are suffering. You just have to say, well, you know, blow you, because it's not a positive story, and that's not right.
Nick, now that you made the film that you wanted to make, do you think you can find a way to forgive yourself a little bit?
Well, it's not really a matter of forgive.
I guess what I mean is,
yeah,
it's obvious that you came away with an enormous burden and a sense of responsibility that you don't feel you fulfilled, and that the rest of the Western community in Rwanda certainly didn't fulfill. And you made this film. So my question is, can you leave it alone now?
Well, the film gives me an opportunity to speak about Rwanda, but I don't get the opportunity to go back and stop by the side of the road and pick up a child who's going to be murdered by the Interahamwe and take him out of the country to safety. And nor does anybody else get that opportunity to do that again. And nobody said anything about stopping it happening next time. So, no, I don't think there is anything really to feel positive about or redeemed about. Not at all. The genocide is the opposite of redemption. There is no redemption. You can't go back. Those people are dead, and it will happen again.
Nick, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Nick Hughes is the director and co-producer of 100 Days. The film will play at the African Diaspora Festival in New York this month. You can find more information at 100daysinrwanda.net.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Natasha Kurgankar. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.